preconceived pattern of thought into which the parts could always be fitted, though often with cement that was all too visible. An event must have happened in such and such a way, in that way and no other. And lo and behold, if that's what the scholars really want, it did happen in that way. We are entitled, indeed we ought, to doubt every accepted pattern of thought or working hypothesis, for if existing ideas are not called in question, research is at an end. So our historical past is only relatively true. If new aspects of it turn up, the old working hypothesis, however familiar it may have become, must be replaced by a new one. It seems the moment has come to introduce a new working hypothesis and place it at the very center of our research into the past. New knowledge about the solar system and the universe, about macrocosm and microcosm, tremendous advances in technology and medicine, in biology and geology, the beginning of space travel. These and many other things have completely altered our world picture in fewer than 50 years. Today we know that it is possible to make spacesuits that can withstand extremes of heat and cold. Today we know that space travel is no longer a utopian idea. We are familiar with the miracle of color television, just as we can measure the speed of light and calculate the consequences of the theory of relativity. Our world picture, which is already almost frozen into immobility, begins to thaw. New working hypotheses need new criteria. For example, in the future, archaeology can no longer be simply a matter of excavation. The mere collection and classification of finds is no longer adequate. Other branches of science will have to be consulted and made use of if a reliable picture of our past is to be drawn. So let us enter the new world of the improbable with an open mind and bursting with curiosity. Let us try to take possession of the inheritance the gods have bequeathed to us. At the beginning of the 18th century, ancient maps, which had belonged to an officer in the Turkish Navy, Admiral Piri Reis, were found in the Topkapi Palace. Two atlases preserved in the Berlin State Library, which contain exact reproductions of the Mediterranean and the region around the Dead Sea, also came from Piri Reis. All these maps were handed over to American cartographer Arlington H. Mallory for examination. Mallory confirmed the remarkable fact that all the geographical data were present but not drawn in the right places. He sought the help of Mr. Walters, cartographer in the U.S. Navy Hydrographic Bureau. Mallory and Walters constructed a grid and transferred the maps to a modern globe. They made a sensational discovery. The maps were absolutely accurate, and not only as regards the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. The coasts of North and South America and even the contours of the Antarctic were also precisely delineated on Piri Reis's maps. The maps not only reproduced the outlines of the continents, but also show the topography of the interiors. Mountain ranges, mountain peaks, islands, rivers, and plateaus were drawn in with extreme accuracy. In 1957, the geophysical year, the maps were handed over to Jesuit Father Lineman, who is both director of the Weston Observatory and a cartographer in the U.S. Navy. After scrupulous tests, Father Lineman, too, could but confirm that the maps were fantastically accurate, even about regions which we have scarcely explored today. What is more, the mountain ranges in the Antarctic, which already figure on Reis's maps, were not discovered until 1952. They have been covered in ice for hundreds of years, and our present-day maps have been drawn with the aid of echo-sounding apparatus. The latest studies of Professor Charles H. Hapgood and mathematician Richard W. Strawn give us some more shattering information. Comparison with modern photographs of our globe taken from satellites showed that the originals of Piri Reis's maps must have been aerial photographs taken from a very great height. How can that be explained? A spaceship hovers high above Cairo and points its camera straight downward. When the film is developed, the following picture would emerge. Everything that is in a radius of about 5,000 miles of Cairo is reproduced correctly because it lies directly below the lens. but the countries and continents become increasingly distorted the farther we move our eyes from the center of the picture. Why is this? Owing to the spherical shape of the Earth, the continents away from the center sink downward. South America, for example, appears strangely distorted lengthways, exactly as it does on the Piri Reis maps, and exactly as it does on the photographs taken from the American lunar probes. There are one or two questions that can be answered quickly. Unquestionably, our forefathers did not draw these maps. Yet there is no doubt that the maps must have been made with the most modern technical aid from the air. How are we to explain that? Should we be satisfied with the legend that a god gave them to a high priest? Or should we simply take no notice of them and poo-poo the miracle because the maps do not fit into our mental world picture? Or should we boldly stir up a wasp's nest and claim that this cartography of our globe was carried out from a high-flying aircraft or from a spaceship? Admittedly, the Turkish admiral's maps are not originals. They are copies of copies of copies. Yet even if the maps dated from only the 18th century when they were found, these facts are just as unexplainable. Whoever made them must have been able to fly and also to take photographs. Not far from the sea, in the Peruvian spurs of the Andes, lies the ancient city of Nazca. The Palpa Valley contains a strip of level ground some 37 miles long and 1 mile wide that is scattered with bits of stone resembling pieces of rusty iron. The inhabitants call this region Pampa, although any vegetation is out of the question there. If you fly over this territory, the plain of Nazca, you can make out gigantic lines laid out geometrically, some of which run parallel to each other, while others intersect or are surrounded by large trapezoidal areas. The archaeologists say that they are Inca roads. A preposterous idea. Of what use to the Incas were roads that ran parallel to each other, that intersected, that were laid out in a plain and came to a sudden end? Naturally, typical Nazca pottery and ceramics are found here too, but it is surely oversimplifying things to attribute the geometrically arranged lines to the Nazca culture for that reason alone. No serious excavations were carried out in this area until 1952. There is no established chronology for all the things that were found. Only now have the lines and geometrical figures been measured. The results clearly confirm the hypothesis that the lines were laid out according to astronomical plans. Professor Alden Mason, a specialist in Peruvian antiquities, suspects signs of a kind of religion in the alignments, and perhaps a calendar as well. Seen from the air, the clear-cut impression that the 37-mile-long plain of Nazca made on me was that of an airfield. What is so far-fetched about the idea? Research equals knowledge does not become possible until the thing that is to be investigated has actually been found. Once it is found, it is tirelessly polished and trimmed until it has become a stone that, miraculously enough, fits exactly into the existing mosaic. Classical archaeology does not admit that the pre-Inca peoples could have had a perfect surveying technique, and the theory that aircraft could have existed in antiquity is sheer humbug to them. In that case, what purpose did the lines at Nazca serve? According to my way of thinking, they could have been laid out on their gigantic scale by working from a model and using a system of coordinates, or they could also have been built according to instructions from an aircraft. It is not yet possible to say with certainty whether the plain of Nazca was ever an airfield. If iron was used, it will certainly not be found, because there is no prehistoric iron. Metals corrode in a few years. Stone never corrodes. What is wrong with the idea that the lines were laid out to say to the gods, "Land here. Everything has been prepared as you ordered"? The builders of the geometrical figures may have had no idea what they were doing, but perhaps they knew perfectly well what the gods needed in order to land. Enormous drawings that were undoubtedly meant as signals for a being floating in the air are found on mountainsides in many parts of Peru. What other purpose could they have served? One of the most peculiar drawings is carved on the high red wall of the cliffs in the Bay of Pisco. If you arrive by sea, you can make out a figure nearly 820 feet high from a distance of more than 12 miles. If you play at "It Looks Like," your immediate reaction is that this sculptor's work looks like a gigantic trident or a colossal three-branched candlestick. And a long rope was found on the central column of this stone sign. Did it serve as a pendulum in the past? To be honest, we must admit that we are groping in the dark when we try to explain it. It cannot be meaningfully included in existing dogmas, which does not mean to say that there may not be some trick by which scholars could conjure this phenomenon, too, into the great mosaic of accepted archaeological thinking. But what can have induced the pre-Inca peoples to build the fantastic lines, the landing strips, at Nazca? What madness could have driven them to create the 820-foot-high stone signs on the red cliffs south of Lima? These tasks would have taken decades without modern machines and appliances. Their whole activity would have been senseless if the end product of their efforts had not been meant as signs to beings approaching them from great heights. The stimulating question still has to be answered: why did they do all this if they had no idea that flying beings actually existed? The identification of finds can no longer remain a matter for archaeology alone. A council of scientists from different fields of research would certainly bring us close to the solution of the puzzle. Exchange of opinions and dialogue would definitely produce illuminating insights. Because scientists do not take the posing of such questions seriously, there is a danger that research will come to no definite conclusions. Space travelers in the gray mists of time? An inadmissible question to academic scientists. Anyone who asks questions like that ought to see a psychiatrist. But the questions are there. And questions, thank heavens, have the impertinent quality of hovering in the air until they are answered. And there are many inadmissible questions like that. For example, what would people say if there were a calendar which gave the equinoxes, the astronomical seasons, the positions of the moon for every hour, and also the movements of the moon, even taking the rotation of the earth into account? That is no mere hypothetical question. This calendar exists. It was found in the dry mud at Tiahuanaco. It is a disconcerting find. It yields irrefutable facts and proves, can our self-assurance admit such a proof, that the beings who produced, devised, and used the calendar had a higher culture than ours. Another quite fantastic discovery was the Great Idol. This single block of red sandstone is longer than 24 feet and weighs 20 tons. It was found in the old temple. Again, we have a contradiction between the superb quality and precision of the hundreds of symbols all over the idol and the primitive technique used for the building housing it. Indeed, it is called the Old Temple because of the primitive technique. H.S. Bellamy and P. Allen have given a closely reasoned interpretation of the symbols in their book, The Great Idol of Tiahuanaco. They conclude that the symbols record an enormous body of astronomical knowledge and are based, as a matter of fact, on a round earth. They conclude that the record fits perfectly Horabiger's theory of satellites, published in 1927, 5 years before the idol was discovered. This theory postulates that a satellite was captured by the earth. As it was pulled toward the earth, it slowed down the speed of the earth's revolutions. It finally disintegrated and was replaced by the moon. The symbols on the idol exactly record the astronomical phenomena which would accompany this theory at a time when the satellite was making 425 revolutions around the earth in a year of 288 days. They are forced to conclude that the idol records the state of the heavens 27,000 years ago. They write, "Generally, the idol inscriptions give the impression that it had been devised also as a record for future generations." Here indeed is an object of great antiquity which demands a better explanation than an ancient god. If this interpretation of the symbols can be substantiated, we must ask, was the astronomical knowledge really amassed by people who still had a great deal to learn about building, or did it come from extraterrestrial sources? In either case, the existence of such a sophisticated body of knowledge 27,000 years ago, demonstrated on both the idol and the calendar, is a staggering thought. The city of Tiahuanaco teems with secrets. The city lies at a height of more than 13,000 feet, and it is miles from anywhere. Starting from Cusco, Peru, you could reach the city and the excavation sites after several days' travel by rail and boat. The plateau looks like the landscape of an unknown planet. Manual labor is torture for anyone who is not a native. The atmospheric pressure is about half as low as it is at sea level, and the oxygen content of the air is correspondingly small. And yet, an enormous city stood on this plateau. There are no authentic traditions about Tiahuanaco. Perhaps we should be glad that in this case acceptable answers cannot be reached by leaning on the crutch of hereditary orthodox learning. Over the ruins, which are incredibly old, how old we do not yet know, lies the mist of the past, ignorance, and mystery. Blocks of sandstone weighing 100 tons are topped with other 60-ton blocks for walls. Smooth surfaces with extremely accurate chamfers join enormous squared stones which are held together with copper clamps. In addition, all the stonework is exceptionally neatly executed. Holes 8 feet long, whose purpose has not been explained thus far, are found in blocks weighing 10 tons. Nor did the 16.5-foot-long, worn-down flagstones cut out of one piece contribute to the solution of the mystery that Tiahuanaco conceals. Stone water conduits, 6 feet long and 1.5 feet wide, are found scattered about on the ground like toys, obviously by a catastrophe of tremendous dimensions. These finds stagger us by their accurate workmanship. Had our forefathers at Tiahuanaco nothing better to do than spend years, without tools, fashioning water conduits of such precision that our modern concrete conduits seem the work of mere bunglers in comparison? In a courtyard, which has now been restored, there is a jumble of stone heads, which, on closer observation, appears to be made up of the most varied races, for some of the faces have narrow lips, and some swollen, some long noses, and some hooked, some delicate ears, and some thick, some soft features, and some angular. And some of the heads wear strange helmets. Are all these unfamiliar figures trying to convey a message that we cannot or will not understand, inhibited as we are by stubbornness and prejudice? One of the great archaeological wonders of South America is the monolithic Gate of the Sun at Tiahuanaco, a gigantic sculpture, nearly 10 feet high and 16.5 feet wide, carved out of a single block. The weight of this piece of masonry is estimated at more than 10 tons. 48 square figures in 3 rows flank a being who represents a flying god. What does legend say about the mysterious city of Tiahuanaco? It tells of a golden spaceship that came from the stars. In it came a woman, whose name was Oriana, to fulfill the task of becoming the great mother of the earth. Oriana had only 4 fingers, which were webbed. Great Mother Oriana gave birth to 70 earth children. Then she returned to the stars. We do, in fact, find rock drawings of beings with 4 fingers at Tiahuanaco. Their age cannot be determined. No one from any of the ages known to us ever saw Tiahuanaco when it was not in ruins. What secret does this city conceal? What message from other worlds awaits its solution on the Bolivian plateau? There is no plausible explanation for the beginning or the end of this culture. Of course, this does not stop some archaeologists from making the bold and self-confident assertion that the site of the ruins is 3,000 years old. They date this age from a couple of ridiculous little clay figures which cannot possibly have anything in common with the age of the monolith. Scholars make things very easy for themselves. They stick a couple of old potsherds together, search for 1 or 2 adjacent cultures, stick a label on the restored find, and hey, presto! Once again, everything fits splendidly into the approved pattern of thought. This method is obviously very much simpler than chancing the idea that an embarrassing technical skill might have existed, or the thought of space travelers in the distant past. That would be complicating matters unnecessarily. Nor must we forget Sacsayhuaman. I am not referring here to the fantastic Inca defense works which lie a few feet above present-day Cuzco, nor to the monolithic blocks weighing more than 100 tons, nor to the terrace walls, more than 1,500 feet long and 54 feet wide, in front of which tourists stand and take souvenir snapshots today. I am referring to the unknown Sacsayhuaman, which lies a mere half-mile or so from the well-known Inca fortress. Our imagination is unable to conceive what technical resources our forefathers used to extract a monolithic rock of more than 100 tons from a quarry and then transport it and work it in a distant spot. But when we are confronted with a block with an estimated weight of 20,000 tons, our imagination, made rather blasé by the technical achievements of today, is given its severest shock. On the way back from the fortifications of Sacsayhuaman, in a crater in the mountainside, a few hundred yards away, the visitor comes across a monstrosity. It is a single stone block the size of a four-story house. It has been impeccably dressed in the most craftsmanlike way. It has steps and ramps, and is adorned with spirals and holes. Surely the fashioning of this unprecedented stone block cannot have been merely a bit of leisure activity for the Incas. Surely it is much more likely that it served some as yet inexplicable purpose. I am referring to the unknown Sacsayhuaman, which lies a mere half-mile or so from the well-known Inca fortress. Our imagination is unable to conceive what technical resources our forefathers used to extract a monolithic rock of more than 100 tons from a quarry and then transport it and work it in a distant spot. But when we are confronted with a block with an estimated weight of 20,000 tons, our imagination, made rather blasé by the technical achievements of today, is given its severest shock. On the way back from the fortifications of Sacsayhuaman, in a crater in the mountainside a few hundred yards away, the visitor comes across a monstrosity. It is a single stone block the size of a four-story house. It has been impeccably dressed in the most craftsmanlike way. It has steps and ramps, and is adorned with spirals and holes. Surely the fashioning of this unprecedented stone block cannot have been merely a bit of leisure activity for the Incas. Surely it is much more likely that it served some as yet inexplicable purpose. To make the solution of the puzzle even more difficult, the whole monstrous block stands on its head. So the steps run downward from the roof. The holes point in different directions like the indentations of a grenade. Strange depressions, shaped rather like chairs, seem to hang floating in space. Who can imagine that human hands and human endeavor excavated, transported, and dressed this block? What power overturned it? What titanic forces were at work here? And to what end? Still flabbergasted by this stone monstrosity, the visitor finds, barely 900 yards away, rock vitrifications of a kind that ought to be possible only through the melting of stone at extremely high temperatures. The surprised visitor is promptly told that the rock was ground down by glaciers. This explanation is ridiculous. A glacier, like every flowing mass, would logically flow down to one side. This property of matter is hardly likely to have changed just at the time when the vitrifications took place. In any case, it can scarcely be assumed that the glacier flowed down in six different directions over an area of some 18,000 square yards. Sacsayhuaman and Tiahuanaco conceal a great number of prehistorical mysteries for which superficial but quite unconvincing explanations are hawked around. Moreover, sand vitrifications are also found in the Gobi Desert and in the vicinity of old Iraqi archaeological sites. Who can explain why these sand vitrifications resemble those produced by the atomic explosions in the Nevada Desert? When will something decisive be done to give a convincing answer to the prehistoric puzzles? At Tiahuanaco, there are artificial overgrown hills, the roofs of which are absolutely level over an area of 4,784 square yards. it seems highly probable that buildings are concealed beneath them. So far, no trench has been dug through the chain of hills. No spade is at work to solve the mystery. Admittedly, money is scarce. Yet the traveler often sees soldiers and officers who are obviously at a loss for something useful to do. What is wrong with letting a company of soldiers carry out excavations under expert supervision? Money is available for so many other things in the world. Research for the future is of burning importance. As long as our past is undiscovered, one entry in the account for the future remains blank. Cannot the past help us to reach technical solutions which will not have to be found for the first time because they already existed in antiquity? If the urge to discover our past is not sufficient incentive to set modern intensive research work in motion, perhaps the slide rule could be usefully employed. So far, at all events, no scientist has been asked to use the most modern apparatus to investigate radiation at Tiwanaku, Sacsayhuaman, the legendary Sodom, or in the Gobi Desert. Cuneiform texts and tablets from Ur, the oldest books of mankind, tell without exception of gods who rode in the heavens in ships, of gods who came from the stars, possessed terrible weapons, and returned to the stars. Why do we not seek them out, the old gods? Our radio astronomers send signals into the universe to make contact with unknown intelligences. Why don't we first, or simultaneously, seek the traces of unknown intelligences on our own Earth, which is so much closer? For we are not groping blindly in a dark room. The traces are there for all to see. Some 2,000 years before our era, the Sumerians began to record the glorious past of their people. Today we still do not know where this people came from, but we do know that the Sumerians brought with them a superior advanced culture which they forced upon the still semi-barbarian Semites. We also know that they always sought their gods on mountain peaks, and that if there were no peaks in the regions they inhabited, they erected artificial mountains on the plains. Their astronomy was incredibly highly developed. Their observatories achieved estimates of the rotation of the moon which differ from present-day estimates by no more than 0.4 seconds. In addition to the fabulous Epic of Gilgamesh, about which I shall have more to say later, they have left us one thing that is quite sensational. On the hill of Kunyunyuk, former Nineveh, a calculation was found with the final result in our notation of 195,955,200,000,000, a number with 15 digits. Our oft-quoted and extensively studied ancestors of Western culture, the Greeks, never rose above the figure 10,000 during the most brilliant period of their civilization. Anything beyond that was simply described as infinite. The old cuneiform inscriptions credit the Sumerians with a literally fantastic span of life. Thus, the 10 original kings ruled for a total of 456,000 years. And the 23 kings who had the arduous task of reconstruction after the flood still managed to hold the reins of government for a total of 24,510 years, 3 months, and 3.5 days. Periods of years that are quite incomprehensible to our way of thinking, although the names of all the rulers exist in long lists, neatly perpetuated on seals and coins. What would happen if here, too, we dared to take off our blinkers and look at the old things with fresh eyes, the eyes of today? Let us suppose that foreign astronauts visited the territory of the Sumerians thousands of years ago. Let us assume that they laid the foundations of the civilization and culture of the Sumerians and then returned to their own planet after giving the stimulus to development. Let us postulate that curiosity drove them back to the scene of their pioneer work every 100 terrestrial years to check the results of their experiment. By the standards of our present-day expectation of life, the same astronauts could easily have survived for 500 terrestrial years. The theory of relativity shows that the astronauts would have aged only about 40 years during the outward and return flight in a spaceship that had traveled just under the speed of light. Over the centuries, the Sumerians would have built towers, pyramids, and houses with every comfort. They would have sacrificed to their gods and awaited their return. And after hundreds of terrestrial years, they actually did return to them. and then came the flood. And after the flood, kingship came down from heaven once again, it says in the Sumerian cuneiform inscription. In what form do the Sumerians imagine and depict their gods? Sumerian mythology and some Akkadian tablets and pictures provide information about this. The Sumerian gods were not anthropomorphic, and every symbol of a god was also connected with a star. Stars are depicted in Akkadian picture tablets as we might draw them today. The only remarkable thing is that the stars are circled by planets of various sizes. How did the Sumerians, who lacked our techniques for observing the heavens, know that a fixed star has planets? There are sketches in which people wear stars on their heads, while others ride on bulls with wings. There is one picture that instantly reminds one of a model of an atom, a circle of balls arranged next to one another that radiate but are not surrounded by rays. If we look at the legacy of the Sumerians with space eyes, it teems with questions and enigmas, beside which the terrors of the deep and the wonders of the heavens pale into insignificance. Here are only a few curiosities from the same geographical area. Drawings of spirals, a rarity 6,000 years ago, Ejioi Tepe. A flint industry credited with an age of 40,000 years at Gar Kobe. Similar finds at Baradostian, estimated to be 30,000 years old. Figures, tombs, and stone implements at Tepe Yasiab, dated 13,000 years back. Petrified excrement, possibly not of human origin, found at the same place. Tools and stone engravers found at Karim Shahir. Flint weapons and tools excavated at Barabalka. Skeletons of grown men and a child found in the cave of Shandiar. They were dated, by the C-14 method, to about 45,000 B.C. The list could be considerably enlarged, and every fact would strengthen the assertion that a mixture of primitive men lived in the geographical territory of Sumer about 40,000 years ago. Suddenly, for reasons inexplicable so far, the Sumerians were there with their astronomy, their culture, and their technology. The conclusions to be drawn from the previous presence on Earth of unknown visitors from the universe are still purely speculative. We can imagine that gods appeared who collected the semi-savage peoples in the region of Sumer around them and transmitted some of their knowledge to them. The figurines and statues that stare at us today from the glass cases of museums show a racial mixture, with goggle eyes, domed foreheads, narrow lips, and generally long, straight noses. A picture that is very difficult to fit into the schematic system of thought and its concept of primitive peoples. Visitors from the universe in remote antiquity. In Lebanon, there are glass-like bits of rock, called tektites, in which radioactive aluminum isotopes have been discovered. In Egypt and Iraq, there were finds of cut crystal lenses which today can only be made using cesium oxide, in other words, an oxide that has to be produced by electrochemical processes. In Helwan, there is a piece of cloth, a fabric so fine that today it could be woven only in a special factory with great technical know-how and experience. Electric dry batteries, which work on the galvanic principle, are on display in the Baghdad Museum. In the same place, the visitor can see electric elements with copper electrodes and an unknown electrolyte. In the mountainous Asian region of Kohistan, a cave drawing reproduces the exact position of the stars as they actually were 10,000 years ago. Venus and the Earth are joined by lines. Ornaments of smelted platinum were found on the Peruvian plateau. Parts of a belt made of aluminum lay in a grave at Yungjin, China. At Delhi, there is an ancient pillar made of iron that is not destroyed by phosphorus, sulfur, or the effects of the weather. This strange medley of impossibilities should make us curious and uneasy. By what means, with what intuition, did the primitive cave dwellers manage to draw the stars in their correct positions? From what precision workshop did the cut crystal lenses come? How could anyone smelt and model platinum, since platinum begins to melt only at 1800 degrees centigrade? And how did the ancient Chinese make aluminum, a metal which has to be extracted from bauxite under very great chemical technical difficulties. Impossible questions, to be sure, but does that mean that we should not ask them? Since we are not prepared to accept or admit that there was a higher culture or an equally perfect technology before our own, all that is left is the hypothesis of a visit from space. As long as archaeology is conducted as it has been thus far, we shall never have a chance to discover whether our dim past was really dim and not perhaps quite enlightened. A utopian archaeological year is due, during which archaeologists, physicists, chemists, geologists, metallurgists, and all the corresponding branches of these sciences ought to concentrate their efforts on one single question. Did our forefathers receive visits from outer space? For example, a metallurgist would be able to tell an archaeologist quickly and concisely how complicated the production of aluminum is. Is it not conceivable that a physicist might instantly recognize a formula in a rock drawing? A chemist, with his highly developed apparatus, might be able to confirm the assumption that obelisks were extracted from the rock by wetting wooden wedges or using unknown acids. The geologist owes us a whole series of answers to questions about what is of significance in certain Ice Age deposits. The team for a utopian archaeological year would naturally include a group of divers who would investigate the Dead Sea for radioactive traces of an atomic explosion over Sodom and Gomorrah. Why are the oldest libraries in the world secret libraries? What are people really afraid of? Are they worried that the truth, protected and concealed for so many thousands of years, will finally come to light? Research and progress cannot be held back. For 4,000 years, the Egyptians considered their gods to be real beings. In the Middle Ages, we still killed witches in our burning ideological zeal. The belief of the ancient Greeks that they could tell the future from a goose's entrails is as out of date today as the conviction of ultra-conservatives that nationalism still has the slightest importance. We have 1,001 past errors to correct. The self-assurance that is feigned is threadbare and is really only an acute form of stubbornness. At the conference tables of orthodox scientists, the delusion still prevails that a thing must be proved before a serious person may, or can, concern himself with it. In the past, the man who put forward a brand new idea had to count on being despised and persecuted by the church and his colleagues. Things must have become easier, one thinks. There are no more anathemas, and fires at the stake are no longer lighted. The snag is that the methods of our time are less spectacular, but they are hardly less obstructive to progress. Now everything is more civilized, and there is much less fuss. Theories and intolerably audacious ideas are hushed up or dismissed by such killer phrases as, "It's against the rules." Always a good one. "It's not classical enough." Bound to impress. "It's too revolutionary." Unequaled in its deterrent effect. "The universities won't go along with that." Convincing. "Others have already tried that." Of course. But were they successful? "We can't see any sense in it." And that's that. "That hasn't been proved yet." Quod erat demonstrandum. 500 years ago, a scientist cried out in the law courts, "Common sense must tell anyone that the earth cannot possibly be a ball, otherwise the people on the lower half would fall into the void." "Nowhere in the Bible," asserted another, "does it say that the earth revolves around the sun. Consequently, every such assertion is the work of the devil." It seems as if narrow-mindedness was always a special characteristic when new worlds of ideas were beginning. But on the threshold of the 21st century, the research worker should be prepared for fantastic realities. He should be eager to revise laws and knowledge which were considered sacrosanct for centuries but are nevertheless called in question by new knowledge. Even if a reactionary army tries to dam up this new intellectual flood, a new world must be conquered in the teeth of all the unteachable, in the name of truth and reality. Anyone who spoke about satellites in scientific circles 20 years ago was committing a kind of academic suicide. Today, artificial heavenly bodies, namely satellites, revolve around the sun. They have photographed Mars and landed smoothly on the Moon and Venus, radioing first-class photographs of the unknown landscape back to Earth with their tourist cameras. When the first such photos were radioed to Earth from Mars in the spring of 1958, the strength used was 0.000000000000001 watts. An almost incredibly weak amount of current. Yet nothing is incredible any longer. The word impossible should have become literally impossible for the modern scientist. Anyone who does not accept this today will be crushed by the reality tomorrow. So let us stick tenaciously to our theory, according to which astronauts from distant planets visited the Earth thousands of years ago. We know that our ingenious and primitive forefathers did not know what to make of the astronauts' superior technology. They worshipped the astronauts as gods who came from other stars, and the astronauts had no choice but patiently to accept their adoration as divinities, an homage, incidentally, for which our astronauts on unknown planets must be quite prepared. Some parts of our Earth are still inhabited by primitive peoples to whom a machine gun is a weapon of the devil. In that case, a jet aircraft may well be an angelic vehicle to them, and a voice coming from a radio set might seem to be the voice of a god. These last primitive peoples, too, naively hand down from generation to generation in their sagas their impressions of technological achievements that we take for granted. They still scratch their divine figures and their wonderful ships coming from heaven on cliffs and cave walls. In this way, these savage peoples have actually preserved for us what we are seeking today. Cave drawings in Kohistan, France, North America and southern Rhodesia, in the Sahara and Peru, as well as Chile, all contribute to our theory. Henri Lhote, a French scholar, discovered at Tassili in the Sahara several hundred walls painted with many thousands of pictures of animals and men, including figures in short, elegant coats. They carry sticks and indefinable chests on the sticks. Next to the animal paintings, we are astonished by a being in a kind of diver's suit. The great god Mars, so Lhote christened him, was originally more than 18 feet high, but the savage who bequeathed the drawing to us can scarcely have been as primitive as we should like him to be if everything is to fit neatly into the old pattern of thought. After all, the savage obviously used a scaffolding to be able to draw in proportion like that, for there have been no shifts in ground level in these caves during the last few millennia. Without overstretching my imagination, I got the impression that the great god Mars is depicted in a space or diving suit. On his heavy, powerful shoulders rests a helmet, which is connected to his torso by a kind of joint. There are a number of slits on the helmet, where mouth and nose would normally be. One would readily believe that it was the result of chance, or even in the pictorial imagination of the prehistoric artist, if this picture were unique. But there are several of these clumsy figures with the same equipment at Tassili, and very similar figures have also been found on rock faces in the United States, in the Tulare region of California. I should like to be generous, and I am willing to postulate that the primitive artists were unskilled and portrayed the figures in this rather crude way, because it was the best they could do. But in that case, how could the same primitive cave-dwellers depict animals and normal human beings to perfection? It seems more credible to me to assume that the artists were perfectly capable of drawing what they actually saw. In Inyo County, California, a geometrical figure in a cave drawing is recognizable, without overstraining the imagination, as a normal slide rule in a double frame. The archaeological opinion is that the drawing shows figures of the gods. An animal of unknown species with gigantic upright horns on its head appears on a pottery vessel found at Sayak in Iran. Why not? But both horns display five spirals to left and right. If you imagine two rods with large porcelain insulators, that is roughly what this drawing looks like. What do the archaeologists say to that? Quite simply, that they are symbols of a god. Gods are of great value. People explain a great deal, certainly everything that is unexplained, by referring to their unknowableness and supernaturalness. In this world of the undemonstrable, they can live in peace. every figurine that is found, every artifact that is put together, every figure that can be restored from fragments, they are all instantly associated with some ancient religion or other. But if an object cannot be fitted into any of the existing religions, even forcibly, some new crackpot old cult is rapidly conjured up, like a rabbit out of a top hat. The sum works out once again. But what if the frescoes at Tassili or in the United States or in France actually reproduce what the primitive people saw? What should we say if the spirals on the rods really depicted antennae, just as the primitive peoples had seen them on the unfamiliar gods? Isn't it possible that things which ought not to exist do in fact exist? A savage, who nevertheless was skillful enough to execute wall paintings, cannot really have been so savage. The wall drawing of the White Lady of Brandenburg, South Africa, could be a 20th century painting. She wears a short-sleeved pullover, closely fitting breeches and gloves, garters and slippers. The lady is not alone. Behind her stands a thin man with a strange prickly rod in his hand and wearing a very complicated helmet with a kind of visor. This would be accepted as a modern painting without hesitation, but the snag is that we are dealing with a cave drawing. All the gods who are depicted in cave drawings in Sweden and Norway have uniform, indefinable heads. The archaeologists say that they are animal heads. Yet isn't there something rather absurd about worshipping a god whom one also slaughters and eats? We often see ships with wings, and even more frequently, typical antennae. Figures in bulky suits occur again in Valcamonica, Brescia, Italy, and, annoyingly enough, they also have horns on their heads. I am not going so far as to claim that the Italian cave dwellers shuttled backward and forward between North America or Sweden, the Sahara, and Spain, Ciudad Real, to transmit their illustrative talents and ideas. Yet the awkward question is left hanging in the air. Why did the primitive people create figures in bulky suits with antennae on their heads independently of each other? I would not waste a word on these unexplained oddities if they existed in only one place in the world, but they are found almost everywhere. As soon as we look at the past with our present-day gaze and use the fantasy of our technological age to fill up the gaps in it, the veils that shroud the darkness begin to lift. In the next chapter, a study of ancient holy books will help to make my theory such a credible reality that in the long run the investigators of our past will no longer be able to evade the revolutionary questions. Chapter 4. Was God an Astronaut? The Bible is full of secrets and contradictions. Genesis, for example, begins with the creation of the earth, which is reported with absolute geological accuracy. But how did the chronicler know that minerals preceded plants and plants preceded animals? And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness," we read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Why does God speak in the plural? Why does he say us, not me? Why our, and not my? One would think that the one and only God ought to address mankind in the singular, not in the plural. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 2. Who can tell us what sons of God took the daughters of men to wife? Ancient Israel had a single sacrosanct God. Where do the sons of God come from? There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. Once again we have the sons of God who interbreed with human beings. Here, too, we have the first mention of giants. Giants keep on cropping up in all parts of the globe, in the mythology of East and West, in the sagas of Tiahuanaco and the epics of the Eskimos. Giants haunt the pages of almost all ancient books. So they must have existed. What sort of creatures were they, these giants? Were they our forefathers who built the gigantic buildings and effortlessly manhandled the monoliths? Or were they technically skilled space travelers from another star? One thing is certain. The Bible speaks of giants and describes them as sons of God, and these sons of God breed with the daughters of men and multiply. We are given a very exciting and detailed account of the catastrophe of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 19, verses 1 through 28. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening when Father Lot was sitting near the town gate. Obviously, Lot was expecting these angels, who soon proved to be men, because he recognized them at once and hospitably invited them to spend the night in his house. The men of the town, says the Bible, wanted to know the strangers. But the two strangers were able to dispel the local playboy's sexual lust with a single gesture. They smote the mischief makers with blindness. According to